This podcast episode has been created for educational and informational purposes and should not be construed as medical, legal, or ethical advice. When seeking such guidance, please use established routes via your trust, defence union, or other relevant body. The opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and may not reflect the views of the RCOA or the institutions they are attached to. Hi there, everyone. Welcome to our new podcast series, which is going to focus on ethics in the law in anaesthesia and intensive care practice. I'm Dr. Paul McConnell, a member of the Royal College of Anaesthetists Ethics Committee. And today we're going to look at the topic of consent. Consent is probably fundamental to everything we do as doctors and anaesthetists, because everything we do follows from obtaining consent. Now, it's my pleasure to have with me Dr. Anna Nelson, who is her PhD from Manchester University. Anna's an expert in healthcare law and consent, with a particular focus on consent in childbirth. Dr. Nelson, Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Paul. It's lovely to be here.
The big thing we should actually start with is trying to come up with a good definition of what consent is. It sort of seems obvious, and sometimes when we're asked to obtain it, from you looking in as a legal person, what is it?
Yeah, I think that's actually a surprisingly big question, one of those things that when you scratch the surface, you find it hard to answer. But to me, consent is an important legal tool which, in theory, at least operates to allow somebody to protect their autonomy and bodily integrity and associated dignity. It's a way of granting permission for somebody to interfere, often with the physical body in the medical case.
Yeah, as somebody once wrote, I think it was, it makes the impermissible permissive in some ways. We often hear when we're at work, somebody said, has the patient been consented yet, or consent's been achieved? It makes it sound like a sort of point event. Is that accurate?
No, and you've picked up on what might be my biggest bugbear in all of healthcare language. To me, consent is an active and ongoing process, but it's also not something that is done to the patient. The patient or the pregnant person or whoever has the right to give or withhold consent. So we obtain consent from the patient. We certainly don't consent them.
Yeah, I always think that that's really interesting. And the other thing that comes up quite often is people say, is the consent form valid? So we'll dispense with some sort of mysteries there. Is it all about the consent form?
Absolutely not. No. Consent form can provide evidence that consent has been obtained, but it is not necessarily proof that that consent is valid. And actually, in many circumstances, we can have valid consent without the consent form.
That's interesting that the word valid has come up there. So what would make the process of consent valid? What sort of things do we need to think about?
Thank you for picking up on this idea that consent is not a point. It's a process. It's temporal, and it can change, and people have a right to change their decision on that. So for consent to be valid, there are a few basic components. The first thing is that the person must have capacity to give consent, and we can come on to that in a bit more detail. And then the consent must be informed, and it must be voluntary.
So that's very interesting there. You've mentioned capacity, you've mentioned informed, and you've mentioned voluntary as well. Before we start to tease down onto those individual parts, I suppose the question is, what happens if we don't have consent from a legal point of view? What does that mean?
Good question. From a legal point of view, if we intervene with the patient in any way without consent, there is potential civil liability, so that's liability under the law of tort or delict if you're in Scotland, and there is also potential criminal liability.
And when we talk about assault, there is or battery, that's not something that we see come up in a lot of consent cases, the big ones that we hear going to court. We hear talk of negligence instead. So what's the difference between assault or battery and negligence?
Good question. And just to tease out, assault and battery in Scotland come under kind of one general heading, and in England, assault and battery are two quite different things, and we would be talking about battery here in the English context predominantly. So the distinction between consent and battery, if we're thinking about it first in purely the civil terms, tort terms, because battery is both a criminal offence and a civil offence, just to make matters a little bit more complicated. But let's stick to the kind of civil side of the law, because that is what we generally see in these cases. There were two key distinctions between liability for battery and liability for negligence. The first is the need to show tangible harm that links to the failure to obtain valid consent. So in battery, what the real core of that wrong there is the fact of touching without consent. Whereas for negligence, we need to show that there was a causal link between that lack of informed consent and then some kind of tangible, often personal injury type harm. There's also a second distinction, and that is the level of detail needed for consent to be valid in relation to each of these heads of action.
Yeah, and that's something I think that the law's really made some big strides on, that second part, in the last few years. And later on, we're going to come and focus on maybe two of the biggest cases around that. I always think it's interesting when we have this idea of negligence and assault and battery, with this idea that you don't really need to do any harm as such from the battery point of view. It's just a touching that's not authorised. Whereas there are several legal points to make something negligent. We can maybe circle back to this towards the end. The bulk of things that doctors are prosecuted under, I'm right in thinking, is negligence when it comes to consent. Is that correct?
Yes, generally claims are brought in negligence around consent.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but do you think that there can be an argument sometimes that the doctor's consent process can be so minimal or can be manipulated in such a way to omit certain things that it could border on a battery?
Absolutely. So the rule around when consent might be so insufficient that it borders on battery is that the patient must be informed in broad terms about the nature of the treatment in order to avoid a claim of battery. I think that there's two things. I think that sometimes if doctors speak very euphemistically or leave out a huge amount of information, and you kind of sometimes see that in the context of pregnancy in which I work, and I think specifically about the context of maybe vaginal exams, you hear some examples of, we're just going to examine you down there. And then there's a vaginal examination. Is that even being informed in broad terms about the nature? We could debate that. And the other thing is that sometimes in circumstances, consent is simply not obtained. And then obviously that might be a battery.
We've talked about this sort of point process, or not being a point process, rather being a conversation. I think that probably then addresses down to the fact that what we actually need to discuss in some ways is what is the ideal doctor-patient relationship? Because that's probably going to be the foundation of any consent. So what do you think, as both a legal expert, but also somebody who might need healthcare at some point in time, what do you think is the ideal doctor-patient relationship?
Yeah, thank you. That's a big question, a huge question, an incredibly important question. And I think some of the language we're starting to see in more recent big consent cases is this idea of dialogue. It's one in which there is open dialogue. But in order to scaffold meaningful or open dialogue, there also needs to be trust between the doctor and patient. And I think really crucially, the patient needs to feel that they are respected and trusted as a narrator of their own experience by healthcare professionals. I think sometimes there are gendered and racialized and classed elements to this. Some people are not seen as trustworthy patients, and then you can't have an open or true dialogue if someone is got their back up or feels like they're going to be judged for what they say. So this kind of real openness and trust, and a real sense of actually listening to what is being said. So I know sometimes as a patient, I've gone to the doctor and I've been speaking about things and they've just stared at the computer the whole time and kind of typed things in. And you do understand about the time constraints and everything, but it's that sort of creating these meaningful opportunities for dialogue. Because just saying, oh, dialogue is important, sort of means nothing unless the conditions in which dialogue can take place are there.
We're going to dip slightly into some philosophical territory here, Abe, just based on that. Do you think patients consent to the procedure or do you think they consent to the person? How much does trust play into that? Are you consenting to a procedure that could be done by anyone competent? Or are you consenting to something being done by this specific doctor?
That is a really interesting question, I think, both philosophically and legally. But let's speak about it philosophically here, just to make that clear, the boundaries of that. I think it really depends. And I think that we have to, in the UK, think about it in the specific context of the NHS, the healthcare system within which someone is receiving care. The answer to that is framed by the nature of the interaction and the nature of the treatment. If I'm giving consent to a surgery and I see that there's a couple of nurses and a surgeon around me and then the surgery lasts longer and there needs to be some swapping out, I think it would be unreasonable to say, oh gosh, I only consented to that surgeon doing it, unless they were specialist in a way that no one else was. However, if I'm in a doctor's waiting room and I'm having a one-on-one conversation and they say, would you mind me doing some kind of perhaps intimate examination? And you say yes. And then they say, okay, and like march in a load of students or another random doctor. Then I think we're in slightly dodgy territory. So I think that's a very contextual question, which I realize isn't the most helpful answer, but I do think it's true.
No, I think that's it as well. I think it was Anora Anil drew the idea of trust within medicine. And she talked about the idea of going to get your car repaired. And there needs to be, when the mechanic lists the faults that are wrong with your car and what they're going to do, you can't be a full expert in that. They should tell you what they're going to do and give an explanation, but you still have to have some degree of trust that goes with that.
Absolutely.
Thinking about then, we've sort of touched on this idea of an ideal doctor-patient relationship. What responsibilities do you think the doctors have then in that relationship as regards to consent?
I think they've got a real responsibility to start by recognising that consent is an active and ongoing process, which is something I know we've already touched upon, and respecting the patient's autonomy in that as the person who can give or withhold that consent. So that kind of ties back to what we were discussing about not thinking that they are consenting the patient, but rather really recognizing that they are in that dialogue with the patient. I think they're under a duty to take, well, I don't think legally, doctors are under a duty to take reasonable care to ensure that the patient is aware of any material risks involved in the treatment and of any reasonable variant and alternative treatments. And that's from the Montgomery case, which I'm sure we will come on to talk about in detail. But in order to think about this in practice, what the Montgomery case tells us is it is both that doctors need to be aware of the kind of risks that a reasonable patient would find material, but also if they know anything specific about that particular patient, we need to think about the risks that that particular patient would find material, which then brings in this idea that a doctor has a responsibility to kind of listen to their patient and what they're saying and to understand as far as they can about what matters to them. Consent sort of means nothing if patients don't have the information that is needed to make an informed decision about whether or not to give their consent to something. So another responsibility that a doctor has is to present information in a way that is understandable to the patient and not to kind of just bombard them with lots of technical terms, but rather to think about how to communicate risk in a way that is accurate but also comprehensible to someone who doesn't have a medical knowledge or maybe access to medical jargon.
Mm-hmm. They're going with that as well. So doctors seem to have quite a lot of responsibilities, and justly so. Does the patient have any responsibilities within the consent process? I mean, there is a dynamic relationship there.
That is a really interesting question and one that sort of always comes up and one that I think we really need to be careful with, because it's very easy to say a kind of intuitive sense that yes, patients, of course, they have some responsibility. And let's take the example of, say, we could say, well, of course, patients have responsibility to share their views and their decisions openly with the doctor, openly and honestly, so that this dialogue can happen. But then we have to recognize the position that patients are in when they go to the doctor. So we can say, of course, they should share all their views openly and honestly, but we must then think about, is there appropriate language translation in place if they need it? do patients go into that space feeling welcomed and feeling able to be open and honest? And have they had positive interactions with healthcare professionals in the past? So I think we need to be quite careful when we're trying to assign patients responsibility like that, because we need to understand the space and the context within which patients are in. And you could, because it seems again intuitive to say, well, patients need to not lie to the doctor during consent. But what if their experience in the past is that when they've told this kind of truth, they've not had access to a certain treatment, or perhaps they've had a referral to social services? So I think trying to assign set responsibilities to patients get very tricky, because mm-hmm. we don't know the context within which each patient enters the healthcare interaction.
Yeah, there is quite a power dynamic there. Do you think that's what the role of the law is, to sort of try and balance this dynamic out? Because I see ultimately the doctor can, I don't want to use the word manipulate in the consultation, but it is sometimes very difficult not to apply your own values or your own emphasis to the things that you're discussing.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important question. And whether it's the law's role to balance out that relationship is also a particularly interesting question. And I suppose we could split off whether that's the law's theoretical role and whether the law can achieve that as two quite separate things. But I think, yes, I think broadly speaking, in setting out clearly patients' rights and assigning and affording patient rights, the law is in theory giving patients a tool within which enables them to come into a medical interaction and say, I should be able to access all this information. You can't just tell me the procedures you think would be valuable, or you can't just tell me the risks that help move me in a direction that you would like me to go in. So in theory, I think the law does a good job of that. I think in practice, we can talk a lot about who has access to legal resources, etc. And that's probably not for this podcast, but it's worth mentioning.
So that's quite useful now, because this is starting to circle back to where we started with this idea of the things that make consent valid. So we've talked about this power dynamic, and one of the things you mentioned was the voluntariness of consent. That means there might be a danger sometimes of non-voluntary consent, or at very least coercion. Now, from a legal perspective and from a lay perspective as well as a patient, what do we need to guard against when it comes to coercion?
Yeah, so to kind of think about what we mean by coercion, I conceptualize it as putting undue pressure on a patient to act in a certain way, which undermines their ability to exercise their free will and make the decision they would wish to make, could they make it. There's lots of things that we sort of need to think about in healthcare when we're thinking about coercion. And I think a really important thing is to recognize as healthcare professionals, actually, that being in the healthcare space, particularly kind of an institutional healthcare setting, is for many people quite an inherently coercive environment. And there needs to be work done to sort of rebalance that. And that's where patient rights come in. But for example, you're sort of physically in the hands of other people. You're in unfamiliar territory. You might not have all access to information that the healthcare professionals do. So I think putting people at ease and really reassuring them that these things are their choice to kind of level that playing field is actually a really important starting point that sometimes goes perhaps underestimated. I think another really big thing for me when we're thinking about coercion in the informed consent context mm-hmm. is the way that risks are communicated and contextualized to patients. So I think the way that we communicate risk can be quite a coercive thing. For example, if you say to patients, well, if you don't take this course of action, your risk of X adverse outcome will double. That sounds really frightening, but it might be that it's doubling from 0.5% to 1%, or it might be that it's doubling from 10% to 20%. And those are two really, really different things. So I think the way that we express risks and explain what's happening and the language we use is really critical as a kind of coercive tool.
I think that's really useful to think about that. Now, we all know just on the sort of coercive side of things, we're all told people are autonomous and this sounds like a slightly paternalistic thing to say, but people are allowed to make bad decisions, or at least bad decisions as I perceive them as a doctor. How far should I go in telling someone they're making a bad decision before you could be considered to be coercive?
That is a really interesting question. And I think part of the answer comes in how you frame it. How far you can go to explain to people what the likely outcomes of that decision would be is one thing. If you frame it as a bad decision, I think already we're in that kind of choppy water. And I know you were sort of saying it there to get the question across, but actually, I think that is an important context, right? It's one thing to say, I really need you to understand that these are the consequences of your decision, and you can make a moral, ethical judgment about whether you accept those consequences. And it's another to say, that's a terrible decision. I don't think you should do that. How far you have to go is sort of one of those questions that feels quite tricky to answer from the outside of a particular context. But I think it's making sure that you are satisfied that you've communicated risk in a way, but not over-egging it. If a patient says, look, I understand. I really understand that those are the outcomes, but I've made this decision, then keeping going at them is becoming coercive. I think if a patient is continuing to engage and wants more information, continuing to have those conversations is important, but it's also critical to contextualize that with the risk information about other courses of action as well. Not just, well, your course of action is really, really risky, but what also are the risks of other courses of action? Not just saying, well, the risks of this are this, but the benefits of this are this. So it's taking that quite holistic approach to the different options.
Yeah, I always find it very interesting because if somebody agrees with me, then we sort of draw a line on it, under it, and move on. And it is this idea of when somebody has a difference of opinions on things, where you draw the line. And I suppose maybe it's like all things in law, the word reasonable and reasonableness just does a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes.
That might be very context specific.
Absolutely. And I would say the thing for healthcare professionals in their security in themselves is always there are people you can speak to within organizations, be that British Medical Association or be that within your own healthcare structure. And if you are unsure, it's seeking that advice and support is really useful.
We sort of talked about coercion there in terms of the information that's been imparted. What about the timing of the consent? Can that then have a coercive dynamic when people are asked to consent now?
I think that's a really important point, and thank you for raising it. I think timing is really critical, and making things seem like an emergency when they are not, or letting things get to the point of emergency because it's easier to say, well, I really need you to make this decision now, can be deemed coercive. I think really attempting to have consent conversations at a time when a patient can pause and say, oh, I don't understand this, or I need a little bit more time to think about it, is really critical. And that isn't to deny that there are real emergencies in healthcare where decisions just need to be made now, but thinking about whether we can avoid bringing those consent conversations in right at that point, or starting those consent conversations at that point. Obviously, a person can change their mind about their consent right up to the point at which a treatment takes place. So inherently, these conversations can take place really close to the line, but it's if we can scaffold them with conversation leading up to something, I think that's a really important point.
And I think this is something that maybe in anaesthesia we've not got quite right just yet for some of the things, because there seems to be an awful lot of focus on the surgical side of a consent, and sometimes you can meet your patient for the first time on the morning of surgery. Do you think when you meet in the morning of surgery, I mean, to my mind, in an ideal world, that should be to check that nothing's changed rather than to give new information at that point in time.
I would agree. And I think particularly, I think anaesthesia is a really interesting thing because patients are being asked to consent to the surgery that is happening to them, whatever that may be. And they may have had lots of conversations about that. But having this anesthesia is almost a gatekeeper to having this surgery that they need. So the kind of nuances of, have they got all the information about whatever it is, the cesarean section, let's go with my expertise, the cesarean section and what that will involve on their body, maybe, but have they also had a conversation about what it means to go under general anesthetic, what that'll look like? And I think when we just meet the surgeon on the morning, perhaps some of the nuance of what whole surgery involves as a package gets a little bit lost, because we maybe just talk about, oh, you really need this hip replacement to really improve your quality of life. And then suddenly you're being asked to give consent to something that on the morning of a surgery, and if you don't consent to the anaesthetist, you won't get that improved quality of life. But actually you haven't had time to think about and discuss your concerns or your queries with the anaesthetist. So I think you're really right. I think that morning of point seems like it's too late, but then we do have to accept the realities of the healthcare system as it is.
Yes, I think that's one of the troubles, as people often point out. If an anaesthetist is spending all their time doing consent, they're not in theatre giving anaesthetics. Yeah. But we need to have some sort of balance, and we need to maybe think of more novel ways of getting information to patients in a way that allows a dynamic conversation.
Yeah.
And not think of the anaesthetic that's got bespoke risks within itself as an afterthought that's tagged on to the...
I think it's particularly important because one of the things that we know slips really unfortunately and really problematically in the healthcare system as it is access to translation or accepting when people need specialist translation. And if you are meeting someone in the morning of surgery and a translator or an interpreter hasn't been arranged, and not a lot of anecdotal evidence of these kind of things happening, there's not really that time to rectify it. And actually in the panic of the moment, people might think, oh, I think they probably understand what I'm saying, so I'll just accept their consent, because it knocks on a whole load of things if we don't. So taking that kind of longer lead up time also would give better opportunity to pull out any issues like that and create a safer environment for everyone who accesses healthcare, regardless of what their mother tongue or first language is.
I think that's really important. And I think that's something that wee bit about the translation services and things is something we can come back to just towards the end. But this idea then, you know, we've talked about coercion, we've talked about voluntariness. So that probably brings us into the real meat of things, the idea of it being informed and then discussing what is important. And it's probably worth just to do a wee recap of maybe where we were consent-wise up until about 2015. To my mind, where we were before, and we're going to talk about the Montgomery decision in case in a second, up until that point, there had been some loose attempts to try and make things more patient-centred, but things were still very much based on a Bolam principle. And a Bolam principle means that you're sort of judged by a jury of your peers. Or as someone once said to me, if you can get enough of your mates to say you're okay, then you're probably fine. I think it's been important because we've gone from this idea then of what the doctor thinks you should know to what an ideal patient might want to know, to this realization that there's maybe no such thing as an ideal patient, and our consent has to be focused on what this patient would want to know.
Yeah.
And that brings us up to the Montgomery case. Now, what are your thinkings on the Montgomery case, if you want to give maybe a wee summary from your sort of legal perspective of it?
So the Montgomery case involved Nadine Montgomery, who is a woman with diabetes who was pregnant. She was not informed of the risk of shoulder dystocia and the fact that having diabetes had really increased that, and the association with vaginal birth in that context. And through the evidence, it came clear that the obstetrician did not routinely inform women with diabetes about this increased risk, because she believed that would mean they would all pick a cesarean section, and that a cesarean section in that context was not in maternal interest. So that was sort of the context of the case. what happened there was the courts found that actually we need to be looking at the individual patient or a reasonable patient in that person's position and thinking about what risks would be material to them. So no longer could we think about what a reasonable body of medical men, and the law is very gendered language, what a reasonable body of medical men would deem reasonable as risk disclosure in that position, but rather that we need to look at it from the patient's perspective.
Yes, I think it's incredible because I think Bolam was 1955, somewhere round about then, and it took us to 2015 really to ditch the idea of just medical men being involved in things to think about the patient. And you'd mentioned what I think is one of the key words very early on in the podcast, this idea of materiality there. So that is what the patient attaches a material significance to. Now, I think we sort of touch on this in anaesthesia because we always, round about exam times, there's always questions about mythical opera singers that are coming for throat surgery and how we might modify our consent, or opera singers that are coming for orthopedic surgery and whether or not we might discuss alternatives to intubation for them. Is that sort of at the core of materiality?
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is I am just going to read what the test for materiality is, just so we've got the kind of legal grounding and then we can discuss around it. But the test for materiality as set out in Montgomery is whether, in the circumstances of the particular case, a reasonable person in the patient's position would likely attach significance to the risk, or the doctor is or should reasonably be aware that the particular patient would be likely to attach significance to it. So what I think is so crucial from this test is it doesn't just let you away with saying, well, the reasonable or a standard sort of 50-year-old woman would want this. If as a doctor or a healthcare professional of any kind, aware of something about the particular patient that might be relevant to it, you have to take that into account. And I think the opera singer example is a really good one. If you're aware that they're an opera singer and their professional life relies on their voice, then yeah, absolutely, a material risk would be risk of damage to that voice in a way that it might not be, or it might not have such significance to somebody else, particularly when weighed up against the other risks and benefits of all the different treatment options in that case.
It's almost as if there's like both a subjective and an objective part to this then. Subjectively, what is important to this patient? Objectively, would it be reasonable that you as a doctor would know that? So the opera singer, the professional athlete, the small petite lady that is pregnant with a very big bump, these all seem things that it would objectively be reasonable that you would understand that. Whereas somebody deciding, I'm being slightly flippant here, that because they're a Pisces, they don't want intubation, that's not necessarily something that would be reasonable for you to obtain.
It would not be reasonable for you to assume, but if in the course of dialogue with the patient, they told you it, and that's why I suppose dialogue where we can within the time limits that we have, et cetera, is so important, is that you can find these things out. But I think that's why it's so important that this little distinction has been drawn in this case where it says, look, generally, you've got this kind of reasonable person and we, you know, there's limits of what we can assume a person would want. But once you know something about that particular patient, you have to take that seriously. And I think that's maybe, for me, a really important element of Montgomery, is it kind of really says, look, you are dealing with an individual person who will value individual things, and you actually do have to really take that seriously, even if it seems a bit unreasonable or flippant or whatever to you. So I think that's how the test kind of mediates that boundary.
I suppose that's it, because if it then became apparent that the person was into, say, again, astrology during the course of your conversation, they have the right to put as much weight on their star sign or what Mystic Meg has said in the papers that day when it comes to determining what's important to them at that point. So it might not have been reasonable for you to have thought of that from the start, but once it becomes evident, you've got to allow them to make their choices based on that and probe a bit further as to what might be important then.
Yeah, and I think to maybe put a less flippant example on, because I think it's maybe valuable to do that, to really emphasize the importance. If through the course of your conversation with someone, it transpires, for example, that they are a single parent who is the sole breadwinner, but also the sole carer for their three children at home, then maybe actually a bit of pain, but getting back up on their feet is much more important. Now, of course, we can have a much broader conversation about what social structures should be there for that not to be a problem. But those are the kind of real details that you might kind of pull out in a conversation. And actually, while you still need to explain that there's a risk of X and Y in this, and there wouldn't be that risk in this option, it's understanding which is better for that person might not be something you can do until you have those kind of details about their circumstance.
Yeah. I think where maybe the objectivity part of things or the reasonable part is probably more important or more helpful for the doctors, maybe in emergency circumstances. And then there's maybe the question about when you are confronted with what is a very urgent case or a true emergency, it might be reasonable to think that you can't get quite the same amount of detail into things. Do you think there might still be then an almost like a role for Bolam at that point in time, where you're confronted with this sort of emergency circumstance that you've got to push forward, and it'd be this idea of what would be reasonable for a doctor to obtain in that circumstance?
I personally am slightly uncomfortable with the use of Bolam, because I think that medical knowledge constructs what's important in a certain way. Medical education constructs what's important in a certain way. There is certainly a role for a test that thinks, look, what's happening here? What is reasonable to do? I'm not sure that I personally would choose to link that to a reasonable body of medical men. Maybe it's a reasonable person, because I think that actually, do we need to defer in that kind of circumstance to healthcare professionals totally? And I think you're right, though. In an emergency situation, things do have to change. And I actually looked up before this what the GMC said about it, and I quite like the way they express it. And they say decisions may have to be made quickly, so there'll be less time to apply the guidance in detail, but the principles remain the same. Oof. And I thought that was helpful. I'm always a little bit reluctant about referring back to this reasonable body of medical men because of the kind of stuff that means we attach weight to that the general public might not.
I think that's it's probably, and again, this is taking a side shot into sort of a more case law side of things. I suppose that's where the whole sort of Blytho idea came from as well. That just Blytho, for our listeners, being another court case where it sort of challenged the Bolam principle in as much as to say, you could have a reasonable body of medical men, but the court could still be the final arbiter of what was sensible and logical. And maybe that's, you know, where we've got to sort of focus on things there. So we had Montgomery. It was a long time coming. It was what was needed for consent to actually bring it kicking and screaming out in the 1950s. There's probably lots of subtleties around it, but there's maybe two big sort of cases or things just to qualify things with it. So 2024 was probably the one that we saw one of the biggest sort of qualifications around Montgomery, which I think was still sort of complementary to it. And that was the Forth Valley decision there. From a legal point of view, what did you think of the Forth Valley?
So in Montgomery, one of the things, as well as discussing material risks and benefits, that was needed to discuss with patients was any reasonable alternative or variant treatment. And that was deemed very important. And I concur with the idea. It's really important because it gives patients a little bit more access to their options that maybe otherwise would have been in control of the healthcare professional to only share which things they thought was right. But it opened up these big questions about what was actually meant by any reasonable and variant treatment and how we would test that. And what the Fourth Valley case did was it said that we referred to the Bolam test. We took a kind of Bolam professional standards approach to determining any reasonable treatment. So what the Supreme Court said there was a doctor who has taken the view that a treatment is not a reasonable alternative treatment for a particular patient will not be negligent by failing to inform the patient of that alternative if the doctor's view is supported by a responsible body of medical opinion. So we sort of took it back round to this kind of Bolam approach to establishing what counted as a reasonable alternative treatment and who got to define the boundaries of this. This kind of contrasts with the broader approach of Montgomery, where the patient, the particular patient, is really at the heart of the test, and it puts the power back in the hands of the healthcare professionals in many ways. This ruling has been subject to debate and critique to the extent at which it maybe tempers the potential of the Montgomery case to really advocate for the patient. I think it's really tricky because I think the realities of a system are both that doctors do have a specialist level of knowledge about what treatments are reasonable or would be recommended in any particular case. But I do come back to my own personal legal critiques or concerns about the way that medical knowledge is constructed and what medical education says is legitimate and isn't legitimate and how much that matches a certain perspective or worldview or set of research, which is based on some problematic exclusions of certain groups of people and perhaps certain knowledge systems as well and different approaches to treatment. So legally, I understand why they've done it. I have personal concerns, perhaps, about the way it could play out for certain people and what it could limit. But I also accept that it's a really tricky thing because there is also sort of medical disinformation and stuff increasingly swirling around the internet. And there is still that space for clinical judgment about what a doctor would feel comfortable offering a patient in any given circumstance. That's a very not clear answer, but that perhaps expresses the complexity of this area and thoughts around it.
It's a good way because it does show the complexity of what's going on. It's the case with a lot of these cases where you actually probe into the individual case, then it makes perfect sense from there. When you look at the Montgomery case itself, of course it makes perfect sense. There are other cases, occasional cases on the very periphery of it that the courts have actually come out and said it wasn't reasonable for the doctor to know that for the patient. And I think, again, what the Fourth Valley case does is at least it puts Bolam in a clearly defined lane as much as it can and emphasises that doctors probably, from that lane, need to stick with the evidence of what's an established treatment there. And in that much, it's maybe helpful from there. The other case I thought was interesting was, and I believe it's Meiklejohn, which looked at the idea of whether a patient could choose their diagnosis rather than their treatment. And this involved a person who the doctor had decided they had a specific hematological condition and prescribed a specific medicine that was indicated for that. And of course, the patient had a reaction to that medication. The patient found out that there was a differential diagnosis and the patient took them to court because he wished the doctor had pursued the differential first. And again, I think this is maybe sort of dovetails into Fourth Valley. I think Meiklejohn was from 2018. It's this idea of you don't necessarily want, the judge said, I think it was, the tail to wag the dog. And the role of the doctor is to come up with the diagnosis and then explore with the patient the treatment options. It's not the role of the patient to come up with the diagnosis. Do you think that's a sort of useful division of professionalism?
It is one of those very interesting cases that I would say absolutely in an ideal world, in an ideal set of circumstances. Yeah, that seems very intuitively sensible. But I am a socio-legal scholar, so I look at how the law operates in practice, which I think is maybe an important caveat to what I'm about to say, is that actually we know that sometimes the law is patients and patient advocacy groups can be further ahead at establishing the diagnosis of particular conditions, particularly perhaps how they affect women or racialized minorities. So, of course, it seems like a very sensible division, but I think there is nuance to the reality of how that case plays out when actually certain populations are really underserved by the current medical education and how that sets doctors up to diagnose correctly or incorrectly certain conditions, which isn't an absolute black and white answer, but going to beg academic and say I can get away with that nuance there.
So we've talked lots about different treatment options. We've probably forgotten to mention one universal option, and that's doing nothing.
Yeah.
Is that something that should be discussed every consent discussion?
Do you know, it's a really interesting question. I think probably, because I think it's almost like the neutral comparator from which all other treatment options can be compared, and it can do useful work in contextualizing it for the patient. I think the one risk is just to be careful how that framed and communicated so it doesn't sound like a, or isn't perceived or expressed in a manner that's quite coercive. If you say, well, you kind of overly starkly say, well, if you do nothing, you'll die, so here are your options, that maybe isn't setting up the discussion in the way you want. But I think, yeah, I think it's probably a really useful starting point, because then a patient understands what those risks are contextualized against. And actually, I might be really happy to accept X level of pain if the alternative is dying. But if the alternative is sort of staying here, then maybe I don't want to take that risk.
And we're trying to do lots of work in giving people structures on how they might approach the consent process. And one of the models that's out there is this idea of BRAN. So discuss the benefits, discuss the risks, discuss the alternatives, and discuss doing nothing.
Yeah.
And from a legal and lay person, there will be lots of subtleties. Is that quite a good starting block for our listeners, maybe?
I think so. It sounds really solid. I think the thing I would add, and it doesn't kind of change the thing, but it's just to make sure we're contextualizing those kind of way that we discuss risks and benefits. So if you're discussing the benefits of one option, make sure you do it for everything. But also if you're discussing risk, make sure, again, we present what that means. So not just the risk doubles, but like actually, what does a double form? How does it differ? But I think as a starting point, that ticks all the boxes. I would be wary of overly attaching too much significance to, I must just checklist this, because remember, it is that dialogue and that kind of open, ongoing, nuanced thing. But yeah, that covers all the main key parts.
I think there was a case, was it Al-Hwami, which looked at how much effort do you need to make in ensuring your patients have understood things? And that brings us nicely back to translation services and things like that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the details of this are a little bit unclear in Montgomery, but the position does seem to be from Montgomery that a doctor needs to take reasonable care to ensure that a patient has a certain level of understanding of the risks. Now, it's quite a lot of words that could be sort of openly interpreted there, but it does ramp it up a little bit from Al-Hwami, which seemed to just say they have to give accurate information. So we're kind of that little bit of moving up. But what I would say is, having had to dig around this in preparation for the podcast, there does seem to be just a recognition that there's a bit of a lack of clarity here, but that is what the law says at the moment.
And then that neatly brings us into this idea of understanding, and understanding might go hand in hand with this idea of capacity, which is a huge topic within itself. And we don't have the time in this individual podcast to go into capacity in a great bit of detail. But from your legal point of view, what do you think are the key things when it comes to capacity that our listeners need to think about?
So the key thing to know about capacity is that the starting point has to be that a patient has capacity, unless we have proved otherwise. We then look to the Mental Capacity Act, which gives us information about when a person would be found to be lacking capacity. So for a person to have capacity, they must be able to understand the information relevant to the decision, and there we bring back in understand, to retain that information for a sufficient time to make the decision, and to use or weigh that information as part of the decision-making process, and to be able to communicate what their ultimate decision was. Now, caveat to that communicate bit, there is a lot of responsibility to facilitate the communication. We can't just say, oh, well, they can't verbalize, so they can't have capacity. There's structures around that. So those are the key components. But I think a really important starting point is actually that the starting point is that a patient does have capacity and should be supported to have capacity, and also that capacity is something which can fluctuate and it is something which is decision specific. So we don't just say, oh, that person lacks capacity. We might find that a person totally has capacity to consent to a blood test or perhaps some kind of small procedure or to taking a certain medication, but they may not have this ability to comprehend and weigh up information to make a big complex decision about a large surgery.
We've talked about this idea as your capacity and context as well. Again, lots of case law around this. But can somebody with mental health issue or mental health disease consent to a procedure?
There is the same starting point there. So the same starting point is it is presumed that they do have capacity unless they can be proven to lack it. But the fact of having a particular mental health condition does not undermine capacity.
And as a last wee point, because again, we will have a separate capacity podcast, when somebody doesn't have capacity, we act in their best interests or to their benefit in Scotland. Do you think there's a lot of parallels then we have to consider between materiality and Montgomery and best interests? What I'm kind of driving at is people don't just have medical best interests.
Absolutely. And I think the law is really, really clear that actually we should be assessing best interests in a really holistic manner, which aligns quite nicely with this idea, I think, that is the court are trying to get through in Montgomery, which is this patient is an individual patient and we need to understand them in their sort of contextualized reality rather than just as a person who wants medical risk and benefit for everything. So yeah, I think that is a nice link to draw.
Anna, it's been absolutely wonderful to have this conversation with you. I know you're going to be back for another podcast where we're now going to focus in really on obstetric care and consent in childbirth. So until next time, thank you for joining us. The Royal College is producing this podcast series to help build an understanding of ethics and law in anaesthesia and intensive care practice, and we look forward to you joining us again soon. And of course, don't forget to follow us at Anaesthesia On Air wherever you listen to podcasts. There'll be new episodes coming along frequently.